Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Webster Tarpley. I assure you, you're in for a very riveting discussion on a very important topic today, the possibility that, my goodness, we don't have enough wars in our hands. Can you imagine another one against a country that would create an even greater problem than the mess we have on our hands now? Forget about the so-called combat troop pullout from Iraq, but that's a different topic. The war still goes on, and the one in Afghanistan is raging. And can you imagine going to war with Iran? Well, that's an act of insanity. Webster is an author, he's a journalist, he's a lecturer, he's a very outspoken critic of U.S. foreign and domestic policy. His newest book, he's got a number of them, his newest is titled Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide to the Greatest Financial Crisis in Human History, and indeed it is. But today we want to talk about the possibility of a U.S. and or Israeli, I might invert the two countries, but in one way or another, a partnered war against Iran if it happens. For so many months now, I've thought the possibility to be certainly less than 50%. But the rhetoric heats up, the events that are going on, what Webster will outline, certainly makes the possibility greater than I might have thought some months back. Webster wrote two articles recently, one on the 21st of July, and I've got a very crowded desktop. He titled that, Obama is preparing to bomb Iran. Doesn't get any blunter than that. And he followed it up on the 10th of August with another one. I'm looking at another website. Sometimes the websites change the title, but the one on this site says, Iran War. It says Webster Tarpley, Iran War on Multiple Fronts. Webster, let me just read just a little bit from your
Steve,
opener.
Steve, if I could, the actual title on that second one was Fidel Castro Warns of Imminent Nuclear War. And it's unfortunate that that got mangled, because that was Fidel Castro, the 50-year leader of Cuba, calling a special session of the Cuban parliament to issue this warning, which is really extraordinary, right? Here you have somebody who is, for all intents and purposes, a head of state, right? Not formally, but that's really what he is. And he says, I've got to get my national parliament together because we have a state of national emergency because the U.S. is getting ready to launch what will become a nuclear war. And I think I can see what he means by the nuclear. I would talk about why it's likely to go nuclear. But that was a big deal. And Fidel Castro is somebody who knows things, right? He's got this DGI, right? Dirección General de Informaciones. That's a pretty competent secret intelligence agency. And you remember they just had this guy from the State Department and his wife who were put away after spying for Cuba for many decades. So he's got people in different bureaucracies around the world. He knows some things.
Oh, indeed so. And he certainly says a lot of things that make sense, Webster. And he is the only head of state, a former head of state, or combination, who was also a very effective blogger. And we're grateful to him for that. Let me just read one line. I was going to read the first paragraph of your August 10th article. Let me just, you set the table, and let me read the last line of your first paragraph. The contours of the coming conflagration are becoming somewhat more distinct and give us reason to fear not just a Middle East regional war, but possibly even a world war, increasing danger that nuclear weapons will come into play. Let me let you take off and explain what you've written about in very disturbing detail, Webster. I must say, you certainly did not give me a restful night after reading your first article.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. Let me just step back to what you were saying at the very beginning, which is that this is not the same old, same old. This is a change. It's a shift. We have some observers who have been going on and on for the last two or three years that there's going to be a war with Iran, there's going to be a war with Iran. Well, no, that was not the case from about December 2007 until sometime this spring, maybe April might be the turning point, or maybe June. That's hard for me to tell. There was a period of about 2.5 years when the danger of the attack was very low, and I think you were suggesting something in that direction. Remember, there had been a national intelligence estimate of the CIA and all that gang in December of 2007 saying, we can state with high confidence that there is no, repeat, no Iranian nuclear weapons program, and there hasn't been since 2003. So for 4 years, no program. Now, for some reason, that's out the window. But what that did at the time, of course, that was the translation of that into practical terms was Bush and Cheney are out of power, the neocons are out, and another group is in. And the new group is dictating this NIE, and they have other plans. And that's these big new Brzezinski group, or the International Crisis Group. Money from Soros, ideas from Zbigniew Brzezinski, and that would be Samantha Power, for example, in the National Security Council today. And their idea was, you can't continue to do these things. You can't continue this neocon routine with false flag incidents, new 9/11s, new Gulfs of Tonkin, and then direct U.S. military attack on everybody and his brother. It just can't be done, right? Because you've got, you know, the military at the breaking point, right? The U.S. Army, a hollow force, a broken force, and so on. So the new idea was you've got to find something else to do. Anyway, what this meant was that there were 2.5 years when the danger of the attack was low. And I would just at the beginning have to preface everything. What has changed? Why has it gone back? And I can mention there are probably half a dozen factors. Let's see if we can touch on at least some of them. And again, thank you for mentioning those essays, because that's between those two, that's about 50 pages of stuff. So I'm sorry you have to plow through. Anyway, I think the main thing was Zbigniew Brzezinski behind the scenes argued, look, I gave you Ukraine, right? Ukraine is actually more strategic than any of these places in the Middle East. It's the Europe, after all, is the prize that the Middle East is supposed to help you to get. But in the Middle East, he said, I can duplicate the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. That was November, December of 2004 when they put a NATO puppet, Yushchenko and Timoshenko, put them into power right there in the heart of the old USSR, right on Moscow's doorstep. And that was a huge geopolitical thing. So the Brzezinski argument was, don't bomb Iran. That's ridiculous, right? That will get you a war with a country which is 4 times the size of Iraq in territory, 3 times the size of Iraq in population. Very bad, and of course they have allies, they have Hezbollah, they have Hamas, they probably have Syria, they have forces in Yemen, they have probably forces in Somalia, and who knows where else. In Central Asia they undoubtedly have things. So don't do that. Have a color revolution. Have the green revolution. Have this Mousavi, Rafsanjani revolution, which if you look at it would be a replay of the 78 revolution under Carter and Brzezinski. It would be the mullahs overthrowing the existing government, because as Hillary Clinton has told us, Ahmadinejad is no longer the mullahs. Ahmadinejad is something like a military government. You could think of him as Nasser in Egypt a little bit, but he's not the theocracy that was in power. Those guys have been pushed to the sidelines. So the idea was have a color revolution, and the high point of that was the June 2009 presidential election. That was when this was supposed to happen. So within the 12 months after June 2009, it became obvious that this bid had failed, that there would not be a color revolution. And of course, the faction that the U.S. was backing, this Mousavi faction, is the death to Russia, death to China, faction, which is like going out into the streets and saying, we're the CIA faction, and we're anti-Russian, and we're anti-Chinese, because that would have been the government that Brzezinski wanted. So the Brzezinski argument really said, why do you want to attack Iran? Get Iran to attack Russia. Get Iran to cut off the oil to China. It was pretty clear to the Chinese that if that Mousavi group ever took over, the oil to China would be cut, because that would be the CIA program. But that has failed. So that's one thing. And then the other thing I would point to, the link between the finance and the strategy, I think, is extremely important to stress. We now have a world economic depression. We have all kinds of panic symptoms from day to day, week to week, and this is continuous, and I think it's actually getting worse. What you have to see about an imperialist oligarchical ruling class, like the London, New York, transatlantic Anglo-American ruling elite, when they see their financial structures collapsing, their derivatives bubble of $1.5 quadrillion worth of derivatives, they go berserk, they go bonkers, they become adventurous, lunatic, they can't calculate the long term, they get into flight forward, they become desirous of anything that's going to promise them a solution. Specifically now, in the last year, really, 12 months or so, the main strategy of London, New York has been dump the depression on Europe, beggar your neighbor, export the depression to Europe, and specifically it meant do a speculative attack on the euro and break it up and then feast on it, loot it, sack it, engage in primitive accumulation against Europe. And the key part of that, of course, was this speculative attack on Greece, Spain, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, whatever else they could do, using hedge funds, using credit default swaps, right? Secret meetings in Manhattan at the headquarters of Moness, Crespi, and Hart, attended by Soros representatives, by the Paulson and Company, SAC Capital, David Einhorn of Greenlight Capital. It's more or less the gang that brought down Lehman Brothers in 2008. And they were going
with
to...
a repeat of 1997 against the Asian Tigers. That one worked.
Something like that, yes. But on a, more, and it was supposed to be a blitzkrieg. And now that's failed, too. And do we have another minute? I thought I heard music.
Oh, no, absolutely. We have a seamless program right to the end.
Oh, we do. Wonderful. Yeah. Well, I'll try to stop for a breath. Anyway, the idea was this was supposed to be a blitzkrieg, and it was supposed to come to fruition in May, June of this year. And that, remember that flash crash on May 6th? Nobody is willing to say in public what that flash crash was, but I think that was actually a bear raid against the euro, a speculative attack on the euro, which boomeranged. It misfired, and it came back against the New York market, because you have this strange phenomenon of the dollar-Dow trade-off. And if you look at the thing that was going on May 6th was not only did the Dow lose 1,000 points in about 10 minutes, but if you look at the euro-yen cross, you will see that the euro lost about 10 or 12 cents compared to the yen in that same period, which is a huge fluctuation for, a very big monetary unit like the euro, well, the two, the euro and the yen. And it seems to me that what they were trying to do on May 6th was to get this panic flight out of the euro going, except that what they found was they could succeed against the euro, but that was also destroying New York, so this was not getting them anywhere. And since then, we've essentially had this, we've had drift going on. And the euro has now recovered. The euro's come up from about 119 to almost 130 or 131 at different times. So it doesn't look like that's going to work. There is some reason to believe that what's going to happen now is not exactly the triumph of the dollar over the euro, but really the triumph of the yen over the dollar and the euro. It's perfectly feasible that both the dollar and the euro will go into the abyss, and the yen will be the last man left standing. So what this all does is drive the Anglo-American policymakers berserk, again, bonkers. And they look at the situation and they say, well, have we ever been in this situation before? Yes. 1973, right? The world was awash with dollars. Nixon had just ended gold convertibility, and there was a lot of idea in the world that it was time to dump the dollar as the world reserve currency and the posted price of oil. So what do you do? Well, Kissinger connives with Sadat, gets a Middle East war, and then this leads to the Arab oil boycott, and you get a 400% increase in the price of oil. And this had actually all been discussed at this infamous meeting of the Bilderberger Group in Saltsjöbaden, Sweden, in the summer of 1973, where the State Department representative talked about possible effects of a 400% increase in the price of oil. So this is something they know how to do. Now, the idea with this today is if either the U.S. or Israel, U.S. and or Israel in any order you want, if they begin hostilities against Iran, then the Iranian response is going to be to try to close the Straits of Hormuz, to interdict the maritime traffic in the Gulf there, the Persian Gulf or Iranian Gulf, according to how you see it. And that will then lead to what? It'll lead to a huge increase in the price of oil. Now, this would be a godsend for the dollar. It would be terrible for the real economy around the world, but a godsend for the dollar, because what it'll do then is suck up all the dollars, right? Right now, there's, you know, the dollar is very shaky. You could have a panic flight out of the dollar at any time, and they've been talking about that for years. But not if you have a 400% increase in the price of oil, because then everybody will be scrambling to get dollars, right, to buy them, to acquire them, as long as Saudi Arabia holds firm with the posted price of oil being in dollars. So I think this is an important difference that in, you know, you look back at 2002, 2003, and the whole problem with Iraq, or indeed, you know, the last time we had an acute danger of war with Iran was 06, 07, and this peaked with the Cheney group hijacking that B-52 at the end of August, beginning of September of 07. And they flew that from North. They basically got it out of the control of the U.S. military and into their own control. The rogue network, really, this gang, flew that from North Dakota to Louisiana, and they were about to fly to the Middle East. It was just on the eve of the Israeli attack on Syria, which was September 7th, 2007. And at that point, something in the U.S. bureaucracy said no. I think it's probably Robert Gates, who was then the head of the Pentagon, said no. He's a Brzezinski man. He owes his career to Brzezinski. He started as Brzezinski's, you know, Girl Friday at the National Security Council in 78, 79, and 80. So this group said, no, we don't want to have this, you know, nuclear attack on Iran, because that's what it could have been. So this phase is also coming to a close. A couple of other things that are worth mentioning. Turkey and Brazil attempting to mediate that nuclear issue, right, this fake nuclear issue, really, because there's no proof. But with Iran, when you get regional powers like Brazil and Turkey who begin to address questions of world strategy, world peace and security, this is alarming not just for the U.S., but for all imperialists. Indeed, the whole U.N. Permanent Security Council membership, I think, is shocked by the fact that Brazil and Turkey showed as much initiative as they have. And now we've got the conflicts growing between Turkey and Israel. The Turks have been rebuffed by the European Union. They've been told, no, right, you can't come in. So the Turks say, fine, we're going to create a new Ottoman Empire, and we're going to really be rivals of Iran, because they both can't succeed in this regional domination. But for the moment, Turkey is sort of out of control, and this freaks out the Anglo-Americans no end, because the whole power projection of the Anglo-Americans in the Middle East depends on the NATO logistical infrastructure, and that would mean, above all, Incirlik Air Force Base in Turkey, and the whole role of Turkey in facilitating everything going into the Middle East. And if Turkey were to leave NATO, which is now, I think, quite possible, who else will want to leave, right? Maybe Italy wants to leave. Maybe, you know, some others want to leave. And once they start to leave, then the U.S. is left high and dry, because the U.S. is fundamentally weak in the most important aspect of military operations, which is logistics and production. Everything that has to do with an economy, the U.S. is looking pretty sick. So those would be three things. What else can we mention?
There was a House resolution. There was a
I'm talking about the causes, right? Not just the, you know, these are the symptoms, right? That a bunch of Republican warmonger, demagogue, reactionaries get up and start popping off. It is of course a turning point in the sense that it's a resolution. I don't think it's been approved yet, but it's the Republicans putting it in, and it basically says we demand the waging of aggressive war. That would land everybody who voted for that would go to Nuremberg under the Nuremberg precedents, because that's conspiracy to launch aggressive war.
I think it's non-binding. It's the Republicans shooting their mouth off. That's what they're doing.
Let me just talk about the military stuff. A lot of people have still not understood that Israel in 2006 was soundly defeated by Hezbollah, right? And what you saw on television here was mainly the Israelis bombing Beirut, and this looked awful, of course, but it was... militarily, what was significant was that the Israeli units that went into southern Lebanon with their Merkava tanks got absolutely mauled, and they scurried out of there. They were basically defeated and repulsed. And that, of course, has shocked the Israeli establishment. Now, what you have today is Hezbollah as a kind of a missile carrier for Iran. And so if you think about the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, Khrushchev wanted to get some missiles into Cuba, right, to get a advantage, having missiles close by the U.S. Well, the Iranians have that, and that's Hezbollah there in southern Lebanon. So up to now, what Hezbollah has had are these small sort of World War II vintage Soviet rockets, which they've fired into Israel. But now they're getting something called the M600, which is a short to medium range ballistic missile. I guess short range, 300 kilometers. But this is guided. This has a guidance system. This is not just fire it and hope for the best. This can actually hit targets. And the result of that is that every Israeli military airport in northern Israel is now of questionable use, because they can be hit by these missiles. And the Hezbollah is reported to have, you know, 200 or 300 of them given by Syria, and I think they do have some anyway. So that could force the Israelis to flee the northern part of their own country with their air force and go south to the Negev. And there, you know, who knows, if Hamas ever got some missiles, then they would be in big trouble there, too. The Iranians have developed 4 or 5 different medium-range ballistic missiles, short and medium-range. The medium-range ones can hit Israel. Some of them have 2 stages. Some of them have MIRVs, right? They can have more than 1 warhead. Now, these are all conventional, but they can also hit things. In other words, they're getting to be, you know, accurate. Now, the Israelis have built this 4-layer kind of anti-missile defense system. At the bottom level, it's called the Iron Dome. Then there's another level called David's Sting. Then there's the Arrow system, and then the Arrow 2, and at the top, the Patriot missile, right? So it's 4, the U.S., right? So 4 layers.
Let me stop you.
Can that be overwhelmed? Well, yes, it could be. If you had...
Hang on one moment. Let me stop you, because we don't have a lot of time left. Let me throw a couple of questions in, because before this program ends, I'd like a push to come to shove and talk about the real possibility, the possible timing of a war, whether the U.S. would join Israel. The likelihood, I think, is very strong. Number one, 2 quick questions. Does Iran, or do they not have these Russian S-300 missile defense that can shoot down multiple aircraft?
As far as I can tell, they have not been delivered, but they've gotten 4 of them on the black market. So they have 2 batteries, one battery from Belarus and 1 battery from somebody they don't name. The Russians have reneged, and this is actually another factor, that you have now the Medvedev peace line competing with the Stern Putin line, and this leads the neocons to be stronger in the councils of the U.S. government. You've also got the fact that Obama has turned so much power over to Petraeus has also strengthened the neocon faction, because Petraeus, of course, is the king of the neocons. He's their presidential candidate. He's running for president. The whole neocon group, with all their money and networks and so forth, have come together behind him. So they're pushing him. How much time do we have?
We've got about 5 minutes. Another big question.
5 minutes. Oh. I thought we had the hour. Sorry.
Oh, no. We have a 30-minute program during the week. We have an hour on the weekends, Webster.
Oh,
a big question is the rhetoric, including out of the Pentagon, has been very hostile, including Joint Chiefs Chairman Mullen.
But well, it changed, right? It was very skeptical, and now in the last couple of months it's become more aggressive, right?
But
and
aside,
the big
from
thing
rhetoric,
you...
aside from rhetoric, and here's my point, in the past the Pentagon was very hostile to a war against Iran. You've got rhetoric on the one hand, and you've got policy on the other. What do you really think those guys are thinking? Do they really want an insane war against Iran, or are they adamantly against it despite their hostile rhetoric?
Well, I think a lot of them don't want it. Mullen was a very skeptical one, but now he seems to be falling in on the warmonger line. Remember, these people are all absolutely immoral, unprincipled careerists. And the fact is, you've got the biggest of the unprincipled careerists is Petraeus, the king of the neocons, and he is now generalissimo and warlord of the United States. And if there's any war with Iran, that will immeasurably increase the power of Petraeus, and I think catapult him into the presidency because of the fecklessness and the general bungling and pathos of Obama. So the fact that Petraeus is now the man of the hour, 99-0 in the Senate, it means that he is the dominant figure, and anybody reasonable is going to be pushed to the sidelines by the Petraeus neocon group caught in a sandwich between the Obama Brzezinski on the one side and Petraeus on the other. And I think Obama, I think, is actually a warmonger, and I think Obama is not somebody who resists these things. He's an obedient servant of Wall Street and the people who put him into power. So.
Oh, I agree. I agree. I think you use so many words and so many adjectives, Webster, and the two articles, 50 pages indeed. The first one was by far the longest article I ever read, but I couldn't put it down. And
Last thing is what to do. We need a primary challenger to Obama. Somebody's got to go into the Democratic primaries, and the sooner the better, on a peace platform, basically down with Obama, dump Obama. Obama is a catastrophic failure. Obama's now the top warmonger. He's got more troops in the field than Bush ever did, still. And he's got to go. And somebody's got to do the Eugene McCarthy, Robert Kennedy, or Teddy Kennedy routine, as we've seen in 68 and 80. We're now back to that, and this Obama has turned out to be the catastrophe that I warned starting in the first week of January 2008, and you got to get rid of him. So somebody's got to come forward. Ed Rendell of Pennsylvania says there will be a challenger. I can't wait. Who is it going to be? Anybody would be great.
Hillary Clinton would be
anybody. It doesn't matter. It just because you get Eugene McCarthy, then you may get Robert Kennedy after that. In other words, somebody breaks the ice, somebody shows that the guy is vulnerable, that he's got a glass jaw, you can knock him down, and then everybody will pile in. So somebody's got to break the ice.
When do you think this war will come, if it comes, Webster?
I don't know. There was the neocons right now. The line from Bolton and these people is in the next 7 days, because they want to stop the Bushehr reactor from getting loaded up with fuel rods.
Exactly.
And then otherwise, you can always look for the dark of the moon. Right. Check that article. I give you the phases of the moon at the end, because it's going to come when there's no moon because of the needs of the stealth aircraft, which are invisible to radar but not very fast and visible to the eye, right? So they go out, they want to do it at night, and they want to have a long, dark night. And according to various columnists, Obama wants an October surprise. According to Arnaud de Borchgrave, Obama wants to have three wars so he can keep two houses of Congress to get an October surprise. And he's perfectly capable of this.
It scares you. It scares me. It would really be insane, and I think he is a guy who will be a pushover if the real powers, including the Israeli lobby, wants a war with Iran. Then Obama will obediently go along with this, and a sheer act of insanity, Webster. We are out of time. Let me say this. I will watch for your writing. I'm sure you're going to have more to say about this if we don't get that October surprise. And then we'll get you back again to update things. And if something is really urgent, I'll have to figure out to do it a little bit sooner.
I'm actually sorry. I've been on your program before. I thought we had an hour. I would have gotten to the here and now, right? The hic et nunc immediately.
I apologize. The next time you come on, You will absolutely come on for an hour. So we will really go into whatever is most pressing at that time.
I hope people will look at Topley.net. You can see these essays, right? Topley.net.
Oh, indeed. Google Webster Topley. It'll go right to your site. They can read the articles. And if they don't want to read 50 pages, they can at least skim through them and just see
the
friendly face.
It's made so you can skim the subheads and get the idea.
Oh, absolutely, Webster. I thank you very much. I absolutely want to have another chapter of this because this is big stuff. Possibility of World War III?
That's it.
It doesn't get much bigger than that. Webster, my great thanks.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
And join us again this weekend, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We may not talk about World War III, but it'll be big stuff. Please do join us and make us a regular habit.